few gigs, we traded our wedge monitors for in-ear pieces. It was perfect sound, as though we were in the studio, the roar of the crowd blocked off. But that was even worse in a way. I feel so disconnected from the crowds as it is, by the distance between them and us, a distance separated by a vast expanse of stage and an army of security keeping fans from bounding up to touch us or stage dive the way they used to. But more than that, I don't like that it's so hard to hear any one single voice break through. I don't know. Maybe I'm still listening for that one voice. Every so often during a show, though, as me or Mike pause to retune our guitars or someone takes a swig from a bottle of water, I'll pause and strain to pick out a voice from the crowd. And every so often I can hear someone shouting for a specific song or screaming I love you or chanting my name. As I stand here on the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm thinking about those stadium shows, of their hurricane wail of white noise, because all I can hear now is a roaring in my head, a wordless howl as Mia disappears and I try to let her. But there's something else too, a small voice trying to break through, to puncture the roar of nothingness. And the voice grows stronger and stronger, and it's my voice this time, and it's asking a question. How does she know? Chapter 18. Are you happy in your misery? Resting peaceful in desolation?
It's the final tie that binds us, the sole source of my consolation.
Blue. Collateral damage, track 6. Mia's gone. The bridge looks like a ghost ship from another time, even as it fills up with the most 21st century kind of people, early morning joggers. And me, alone again. But I'm still standing. I'm still breathing, and somehow, I'm okay. But still, the question is gaining momentum and volume. How does she know? Because I never told anyone what I asked of her. Not the nurses, not the grandparents, not Kim, and not Mia. So how does she know? If you stay, I'll do whatever you want. I'll quit the band, go with you to New York. But if you need me to go away, I'll do that too. Maybe coming back to your old life would just be too painful. Maybe it'd be easier for you to erase us. And that would suck, but I'd do it. I can lose you like that if I don't lose you today. I'll let you go. If you stay. That was my vow. And it's been my secret, my burden, my shame, that I asked her to stay, that she listened. Because after I promised her what I promised her, and played her a Yo-Yo Ma cello piece, it had seemed as if she had heard. She'd squeezed my hand, and I'd thought it was going to be like in the movies, but all she'd done was squeeze, and stayed unconscious. But that squeeze had turned out to be her first voluntary muscle movement. It was followed by more squeezes, then by her eyes opening for a flutter or two, and then longer. One of the nurses had explained that Mia's brain was like a baby bird trying to poke its way out of an eggshell, and that squeeze was the beginning of an emergence that went on for a few days until she woke up and asked for water. Whenever she talked about the accident, Mia said the entire week was a blur. She didn't remember a thing. And I wasn't about to tell her about the promise I'd made, a promise that, in the end, I was forced to keep. But she knew. No wonder she hates me. In a weird way, it's a relief. I'm so tired of carrying this secret around. I'm so tired of feeling bad for making her live and feeling angry at her for living without me and feeling like a hypocrite for the whole mess. I stand there on the bridge for a while, letting her get away. And then I walk the remaining few hundred feet to the ramp down. I've seen dozens of taxis pass by on the roadway below. So even though I have no clue where I am, I'm pretty sure I'll find a cab to bring me back to my hotel. But when I get down the ramp, I'm in a plaza area, not where the car traffic lets out. I flag down a jogger, a middle-aged guy, chugging off the bridge, and ask where I can get a taxi, and he points me toward a bunch of buildings. There's usually a queue on weekdays. I don't know about weekends, but I'm sure you'll find a cab somewhere. He's wearing an iPod and has pulled out the earbuds to talk to me, but the music is still playing, and it's Fugazi. The guy's running to Fugazi, the very tail end of Smallpox Champion. Then the song clicks over and it's Wild Horses by the Rolling Stones. And the music, it's like, I don't know, fresh bread on an empty stomach, or a wood stove on a frigid day. It's reaching out of the earbuds and beckoning me. The guy keeps looking at me. "Are you Adam Wilde? From Shooting Star?" he asks. Not at all fan-like, just curious. It takes a lot of effort to stop listening to the music and give him my attention. "Yeah." I reach out my hand. "I don't mean to be rude," he says after we shake. "But what are you doing walking around Brooklyn at 6:30 on a Saturday morning? Are you lost or something?" "No, I'm not lost. Not anymore, anyway." Mick Jagger is crooning away, and I practically have to bite my lip to keep from singing along. It used to be I never went anywhere without my tunes, and then it was like everything else. Take it or leave it. But now I'll take it. Now I need it. "Can I ask you for an insanely huge and just plain insane favor?" I ask. "Okay. Can I borrow your iPod, just for the day? If you give me your name and address, I'll have it messengered over to you. I promise you'll have it back by tomorrow's run." He shakes his head, laughs. "One butt crack of Don Run a weekend is enough for me. But yeah, you can borrow it. The buzzer on my building doesn't work, so just deliver it to Nick at the Southside Cafe on 6th Avenue in Brooklyn. I'm in there every morning." "Nick, Southside Cafe, 6th Avenue, Brooklyn. I won't forget, I promise." "I believe you," he says, spooling the wires. "I'm afraid you won't find any Shooting Star on there." "Better yet, I'll have this back to you by tonight." "Don't worry about it," he says. "Battery was fully charged when I left, so you should be good for at least an hour. The thing's a dinosaur," he chuckles softly. Then he takes off running, tossing a wave at me without looking back. I plug myself into the iPod. It's truly battered. I make a note to get him a new one when I return this one. I scroll through his collection. Everything from Charlie Parker to Minutemen to Yola Tango. He's got all these playlists. I choose one titled Good Songs. And when the piano riff at the start of the new Pornographers' Challengers kicks in, I know I've put myself in good hands. Next up is some Andrew Bird, followed by a kick-ass Billy Bragg and Wilco song I haven't heard in years. And then Sufjan Stevens' Chicago, which is a song I used to love but had to stop listening to because it always made me feel too stirred up. But now, it's just right. It's like a cool bath after a fever sweat, helping to soothe the itch of all those unanswerable questions I just can't be tormenting myself with anymore. I spin the volume up all the way, so it's blasting even my battle-worn eardrums. That, along with the racket of downtown Brooklyn waking up, metal grates grinding and buses chugging, is pretty damn loud. So when a voice pierces the din, I almost don't hear it. But there it is. The voice I've been listening for all these years. "Adam!" it screams. I don't believe it at first. I turn off Sufjan. I look around. And then there she is, in front of me now. Her face streaked with tears, saying my name again like it's the first word I've ever heard. I let go. I truly did. But there she is, right in front of me. "I thought I'd lost you. I went back and looked for you on the bridge, but I didn't see you, and I figured you'd walk back to the Manhattan side, and I got this dumb idea that I could beat you over in a cab and ambush you on the other side. I know this is selfish. I heard what you said up there on the bridge, but we can't leave it like that. I can't. Not again. We have to say goodbye differently. Bet..." "Mia?" I interrupt. My voice is a question mark and a caress. It stops her babbling cold. "How did you know?" The question is out of the blue, yet she seems to know exactly what I'm asking about.
"Oh, that," she says. "That's complicated."
I start to back away from her. I have no right to ask her, and she isn't under any obligation to tell me. "It's okay. We're good now. I'm good now."
"No, Adam, stop," Mia says.
I stop.
"I want to tell you. I need to tell you everything. I just think I need some coffee before I can get it together enough to explain."
She leads me out of downtown, into a historic district, to a bakery on a cobblestone street. Its windows are darkened, the door locked. By all signs, the place is closed. But Mia knocks, and within a minute, a bushy-haired man with flour clinging to his unruly beard swings open the door and shouts "Bonjour" to Mia and kisses her on both cheeks. Mia introduces me to Hassan, who disappears into the bakery, leaving the door open so that the warm aroma of butter and vanilla waft into the morning air. He returns with 2 large cups of coffee and a brown paper bag, already staining dark with butter. She hands me my coffee, and I open it to see it steaming and black, just like I like it. It's morning now. We find a bench on the Brooklyn Heights promenade, another one of Mia's favorite New York spots, she tells me. It's right on the East River, with Manhattan so close you can almost touch it. We sit in companionable silence, sipping our coffee, eating Hassan's still warm croissants. And it feels so good. So like old times that part of me would like to just click a magic stopwatch, exist in this moment forever. Except there are no magic stopwatches, and there are questions that need to be answered. Mia, however, seems in no rush. She sips, she chews, she looks out at the city. Finally, when she's drained her coffee, she turns to me.
I didn't lie before when I said I didn't remember anything about the accident or after, she begins. But then, I did start remembering things. Not exactly remembering, but hearing details of things and having them feel intensely familiar. I told myself it was because I'd heard the stories over and over, but that wasn't it. Fast forward about 1.5 years. I'm on my 7th or 8th therapist.
So you are in therapy?
She gives me a cockeyed look. Of course I am. I used to go through shrinks like shoes. They all told me the same thing.
Which is?
That I was angry. That I was angry the accident happened. That I was angry I was the only survivor. That I was angry at you.
She turns to me with an apologetic grimace.
The other stuff all made sense, but you, I didn't get. I mean, why you? But I was. I could feel how...
She trails off for a second.
Furious I was.
She finishes quietly.
There were all the obvious reasons how you withdrew from me, how much the accident changed us. But it didn't add up to this lethal fury I suddenly felt once I got away. I think really, somewhere in me, I must have known all along that you asked me to stay, way before I actually remembered it. Does that make any sense?
No. Yes. I don't know. None of this makes sense, I say.
I know. So I was angry with you. I didn't know why. I was angry with the world. I did know why. I hated all my therapists for being useless. I was this little ball of self-destructive fury, and none of them could do anything but tell me that I was a little ball of self-destructive fury. Until I found Nancy, not one of them helped me as much as my Juilliard profs did. I mean, hello, I knew I was angry. Tell me what to do with the anger, please. Anyhow, Ernesto suggested hypnotherapy. It helped him quit smoking, I guess.
She elbows me in the ribs. Of course Mr. Perfect wouldn't smoke, and of course he'd be the one who helped Mia unearth the reason she hates me.
It was kind of risky, Mia continues. Hypnosis tends to unlock hidden memories. Some trauma is just too much for the conscious mind to handle, and you have to go in through a back door to access it. So I reluctantly submitted to a few sessions. It wasn't what I thought it would be. No swinging amulet, no metronome. It was more like those guided imagery exercises they'd sometimes have us do at camp. At first, nothing happened. And then I went to Vermont for the summer and quit. But a few weeks later, I started to get these flashes, random flashes, like I could remember a surgery, could actually hear the specific music the doctors played in the operating room. I thought about calling them to ask if what I remembered was true, but so much time had passed, I doubted they'd remember. Besides, I didn't really feel like I needed to ask them. My dad used to say that when I was born, I looked so totally familiar to him. He was overwhelmed with this feeling that he'd known me all his life, which was funny considering how little I looked like him or Mom. But when I had my first memories, I felt that same certainty, that they were real and mine. I didn't put the pieces together fully until I was working on a cello piece. A lot of memories seem to hit when I'm playing. Anyhow, it was Gershwin. Andante con moto e poco rubato.
I open my mouth to say something, but at first nothing comes out.
I played you that,
I finally say.
I know.
She doesn't seem surprised by my confirmation. I lean forward, put my head between my knees, and take deep breaths. I feel Mia's hand gently touch the back of my neck.
Adam?
Her voice is tentative.
There's more. And here's where it gets a little freaky. It makes a certain sense to me that my mind somehow recorded the things that were happening around my body while I was unconscious. But there are other things. Other memories.
Like what? My voice is a whisper.
Most of it is hazy, but I have certain strong memories of things I couldn't know because I wasn't there. I have this one memory. It's of you. It's dark out, and you're standing outside the hospital entrance under the floodlights, waiting to come see me. You're wearing your leather jacket and looking up, like you're looking for me. Did you do that?
Mia cups my chin up and lifts my face, this time apparently seeking some affirmation that this moment was real. I want to tell her that she's right, but I've completely lost the ability to speak. My expression, however, seems to offer the validation she's after. She nods her head slightly.
How? How, Adam? How could I know that?
I'm not sure if the question's rhetorical or if she thinks I have a clue to her metaphysical mystery. And I'm in no state to answer either way because I'm crying. I don't realize it till I taste the salt against my lips. I can't remember the last time I've cried, but once I accept the mortification of sniveling like a baby, the floodgates open and I'm sobbing now in front of Mia. In front of the whole damn world. Chapter 19. The first time I ever saw Mia Halt was 6 years ago. Our high school had this arts program, and if you chose music as your elective, you could take music classes or opt for independent study to practice in the studios. Mia and I both went for the independent study. I'd seen her playing her cello a couple of times, but nothing had really registered. I mean, she was cute and all, but not exactly my type. She was a classical musician. I was a rock guy. Oil and water and all that. I didn't really notice her until the day I saw her not playing. She was just sitting in one of the soundproof practice booths, her cello resting gently against her knees, her bow poised a few inches above the bridge. Her eyes were closed and her brow was a little furrowed. She was so still. It seemed like she'd taken a brief vacation from her body. And even though she wasn't moving, even though her eyes were closed, I somehow knew that she was listening to music then, was grabbing the notes from the silence, like a squirrel gathering acorns for the winter before she got down to the business of playing. I stood there, suddenly riveted by her, until she seemed to wake up and start playing with this intense concentration. When she finally looked at me, I hustled away. After that, I became kind of fascinated by her, and by what I guessed was her ability to hear music in the silence. Back then, I'd wanted to be able to do that, too. So I took to watching her play, and though I told myself the reason for my attention was because she was as dedicated a musician as I was, and that she was cute, the truth was that I also wanted to understand what she heard in the silence. During all the time we were together, I don't think I ever found out. But once I was with her, I didn't need to. We were both music-obsessed, each in our own way. If we didn't entirely understand the other person's obsession, it didn't matter, because we understood our own. I know the exact moment Mia is talking about. Kim and I had driven to the hospital in Sarah's pink Dodge Dart. I don't remember asking Liz's girlfriend to borrow her car. I don't remember driving it. I don't remember piloting the car up into the hills where the hospital is, or how I even knew the way. Just that one minute I was in a theater in downtown Portland, soundchecking for that night's show, when Kim showed up to deliver the awful news. And the next minute, I was standing outside the hospital. What Mia inexplicably remembers, it's sort of the first pinpoint of clarity in that whole petri dish blur between hearing the news and arriving at the trauma center. Kim and I had just parked the car, and I'd walked out of the garage ahead of her. I'd needed a couple of seconds to gather my strength, to steel myself for what I was about to face. And I'd remembered looking at the hulking hospital building and wondering if Mia was somewhere in there, and feeling a heart and throat panic that she died in the time it had taken Kim to fetch me. But then I'd felt this wave of something. Not really hope, not really relief, but just a sort of knowledge that Mia was still in there. And that had been enough to pull me through the doors. They say that things happen for a reason, but I don't know that I buy that. I don't know that I'll ever see a reason for what happened to Kat, Denny, and Teddy that day. But it took forever to get in to see Mia. I got turned away from the ICU by Mia's nurses, and then Kim and I devised this whole plan to sneak in. I don't think I realized it at the time, but I think in a weird way, I was probably stalling. I was gathering my strength. I didn't want to lose it in front of her. I guess part of me somehow knew that Mia, deep in her coma, would be able to tell. Of course, I ended up losing it in front of her anyway. When I finally saw her the first time, I almost blew chunks. Her skin looked like tissue paper. Her eyes were covered with tape. Tubes ran in and out of every part of her body, pumping liquids and blood in and draining some scary-ass shit out. I'm ashamed to say it, but when I first came in, I wanted to run away. But I couldn't. I wouldn't. So instead, I just focused on the part of her that still looked remotely like Mia, her hands. There were monitors stuck to her fingers, but they still looked like her hands. I touched the fingertips of her left hand, which felt worn and smooth, like old leather. I ran my fingers across the nubby calluses of her thumbs. Her hands were freezing, just like they always were. So I warmed them, just like I always did. And it was while warming her hands that I thought about how lucky it was that they looked okay. Because without hands, there'd be no music. And without music, she'd have lost everything. And I remember thinking that somehow Mia had to realize that too. That she needed to be reminded that she had the music to come back to. I ran out of the ICU, part of me fearing that I might never see her alive again, but somehow knowing that I had to do this one thing. When I came back, I played her the Yo-Yo Ma, and that's also when I made her the promise that she's held me to. I did the right thing. I know it now. I must have always known, but it's been so hard to see through all my anger. And it's okay if she's angry. It's even okay if she hates me. It was selfish what I asked her to do, even if it wound up being the most unselfish thing I've ever done. The most unselfish thing I'll have to keep doing. But I'd do it again. I know that now. I'd make that promise 1,000 times over, and lose her 1,000 times over, to have heard her play last night, or to see her in the morning sunlight, or even without that, just to know that she's somewhere out there, alive. Mia watches me lose my shit all over the promenade. She bears witness as the fissures open up, the lava leaking out, this great explosion of what, I guess, to her must look like grief. But I'm not crying out of grief. I'm crying out of gratitude. Chapter 20. Someone wake me when it's over, when the evening silence softens golden. Just lay me on a bed of clover. Oh, I need help with this burden. Hush. Collateral damage, track 13. When I get a grip over myself and calm down, my limbs feel like they're made of dead wood. My eyes start to droop. I just drank a huge cup of insanely strong coffee, and it might as well have been laced with sleeping pills. I could lie down right here on this bench. I turn to Mia. I tell her I need to sleep. "My place is a few blocks away," she says. "You can crash there." I have that floppy calm that follows a cry. I haven't felt this way since I was a child, a sensitive kid, who would scream at some injustice or another until all cried out. My mother would tuck me into bed. I picture Mia tucking me into a single boy's bed, pulling the Buzz Lightyear sheets up to my chin. It's full-on morning now. People are awake and out and about. As we walk, the quiet residential area gives way to a commercial strip, full of boutiques, cafes, and the hipsters who frequent them. I'm recognized, but I don't bother with any subterfuge. No glasses, no cap. I don't try to hide at all. Mia weaves among the growing crowds and then turns off onto a leafy side street full of brownstones and brick buildings. She stops in front of a small red brick carriage house. "Home sweet home." "It's a sublet from a professional violinist who's with the Vienna Philharmonic now. I've been here a record 9 months. I follow her into the most compact house I've ever seen. The first floor consists of little more than a living room and kitchen, with a sliding glass door leading out to a garden that's twice as deep as the house. There's a white sectional couch, and she motions for me to lie down on it. I kick off my shoes and flop onto one of the sections, sinking into the plush cushions. Mia lifts my head, places a pillow underneath it, and a soft blanket over me, tucking me in just as I'd hoped she would. I listen for the sound of her footsteps on the stairs up to what must be the bedroom, but instead I feel a slight bounce in the upholstery as Mia takes up a position on the other end of the couch. She rustles her legs together a few times. Her feet are only inches away from my own. Then she lets out a long sigh, and her breathing slows into a rhythmic pattern. She's asleep. Within minutes, so am I. When I wake up, light is flooding the apartment, and I feel so refreshed that for a second I'm sure I've slept for 10 hours and have missed my flight. But a quick glance at the kitchen clock shows me it's just before 2 o'clock, still Saturday. I've only been asleep for a few hours, and I have to meet Aldous at the airport at 5. Mia is still asleep, breathing deeply and almost snoring. I watch her there for a while. She looks so peaceful and so familiar. Even before I became the insomniac I am now, I always had problems falling asleep at night, whereas Mia would read a book for 5 minutes, roll onto her side, and be gone. A strand of hair has fallen onto her face, and it gets sucked into her mouth and back out again with each inhalation and exhalation. Without even thinking, I lean over and move the strand away, my finger accidentally brushing her lips. It feels so natural, so much like the last 3 years haven't passed, that I'm almost tempted to stroke her cheeks, her chin, her forehead. Almost, but not quite. It's like I'm seeing Mia through a prism, and she's mostly the girl I knew, but something has changed. The angles are off, and so now the idea of me touching a sleeping Mia isn't sweet or romantic. It's stalkerish. I straighten up and stretch out my limbs. I'm about to wake her, but can't quite bring myself to. Instead, I walk around her house. I was so out of it when we came in a few hours ago, I didn't really take it in. Now that I do, I see that it looks oddly like the house Mia grew up in. There's the same mismatched jumble of pictures on the wall. A velvet Elvis, a 1955 poster advertising the World Series between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Yankees, and the same decorative touches, like chili pepper lights festooning the doorways. And photos, they're everywhere, hanging on the walls, covering every inch of counter and shelf space. Hundreds of photos of her family, including what seemed to be the photos that once hung in her old house. There's Kat and Denny's wedding portrait, a shot of Denny in a spiked leather jacket holding a tiny baby Mia in one of his hands. 8-year-old Mia, a giant grin on her face, clutching her cello. Mia and Kat holding a red-faced Teddy minutes after he was born. There's even that heartbreaking shot of Mia reading to Teddy, the one that I could never bear to look at Mia's grandparents, though somehow here, in Mia's place, it doesn't give me that same kick in the gut. I walk through the small kitchen and there's a veritable gallery of shots of Mia's grandparents in front of a plethora of orchestra pits, of Mia's aunts and uncles and cousins hiking through Oregon mountains or lifting up pints of ale. There are a jumble of shots of Henry and Willow and Trixie and the little boy who must be Theo. There are pictures of Kim and Mia from high school and one of the two of them posing on top of the Empire State Building. A jolting reminder that their relationship wasn't truncated. They have a history of which I know nothing. There's another picture of Kim wearing a flak jacket, her hair tangled and down and blowing in a dusty wind. There are pictures of musicians in formal wear, holding flutes of champagne, of a bright-eyed man in a tux with a mass of wild curls holding a baton, and the same guy conducting a bunch of ratty-looking kids, and then him again, next to a gorgeous black woman, kissing a not-ratty-looking kid. This must be Ernesto. I wander into the back garden for my wake-up smoke. I pat my pockets, but all I find there is my wallet, my sunglasses, the borrowed iPod, and the usual assortment of guitar picks that always seem to live on me. Then I remember that I must have left my cigarettes on the bridge. No smokes, no pills. I guess today is the banner day for quitting bad habits. I come back inside and take another look around. This isn't the house I expected. From all our talk of moving, I'd imagined a place full of boxes, something impersonal and antiseptic. And despite what she'd said about spirits, I wouldn't have guessed that she'd surround herself so snugly with her ghosts. Except for my ghost. There's not a single picture of me, even though Kat included me in so many of the family shots. She'd even hung a framed photo of me and Mia and Teddy in Halloween costumes above their old living room mantel, a place of honor in the Hall home. But not here. There are none of the silly shots Mia and I used to take of each other and of ourselves kissing or mugging while one of us held the camera at arm's length. I love those pictures. They always cut off half a head or were obscured by someone's finger, but they seem to capture something true. I'm not offended. Earlier I might have been. But I get it now. Whatever place I held in Mia's life, in Mia's heart, was irrevocably altered that day in the hospital 3.5 years ago. Closure. I loathe that word. Shrinks love it. Bryn loves it. She says that I've never had closure with Mia. More than 5 million people have bought and listened to my closure, is my standard reply. Standing here in this quiet house where I can hear the birds chirping out back, I think I'm kind of getting the concept of closure. It's no big dramatic before after. It's more like that melancholy feeling you get at the end of a really good vacation. Something special is ending, and you're sad, but you can't be that sad because, hey, it was good while it lasted. And there'll be other vacations, other good times. But they won't be with Mia. Or with Bryn. I glance at the clock. I need to get back to Manhattan, pack up my stuff, reply to the most urgent of the emails that have no doubt piled up, and get myself to the airport. I'll need to get a cab out of here, and before that, I'll need to wake Mia up and say a proper goodbye. I decide to make coffee. The smell of it alone used to rouse her. On the mornings I used to sleep at her house, sometimes I woke up early to hang with Teddy. After I let her sleep to a decent hour, I'd take the percolator right into her room and waft it around until she lifted her head from the pillow, her eyes all dreamy and soft. I go into the kitchen and instinctively seem to know where everything is, as though this is my kitchen and I've made coffee here 1,000 times before. The metal percolator is in the cabinet above the sink, the coffee in a jar on the freezer door. I spoon the rich, dark powder into the chamber atop the percolator, then fill it with water and put it on the stove. The hissing sound fills the air, followed by the rich aroma. I can almost see it, like a cartoon cloud floating across the room, prodding Mia awake. And sure enough, before the whole pot is brewed, she's stretching out on the couch, gulping a bit for air like she does when she's waking up. When she sees me in her kitchen, she looks momentarily confused. I can't tell if it's because I'm bustling around like a housewife, or just because I'm here in the first place. Then I remember what she said about her daily wake-up call of loss. "Are you remembering it all over again?" I ask the question, out loud, because I want to know, and because she asked me to ask. "No," she says. "Not this morning." She yawns, then stretches again. "I thought I dreamed last night. Then I smelled coffee."
"Sorry," I mutter.
She's smiling as she kicks off her blanket. "Do you really think that if you don't mention my family, I'll forget them?"
"No," I admit. "I guess not."
"And as you can see, I'm not trying to forget." Mia motions to the photos.
"I was looking at those. Pretty impressive gallery you've got, of everyone."
"Thanks. They keep me company."
I look at the pictures, imagining that one day Mia's own children will fill more of her frames, creating a new family for her, a continuing generation that I won't be a part of.
"I know they're just pictures," she continues, "but some days they really help me to get up in the morning. Well, them and coffee."
"Ah, the coffee." I go to the kitchen and open the cabinets where I know the cups will be, though I'm a little startled to find that even these are the same collection of 1950s and 60s ceramic mugs that I've used so many times before, amazed that she's hauled them from dorm to dorm, from apartment to apartment. I look around for my favorite mug, the one with the dancing coffee pots on it, and I'm so damn happy to find it's still here. It's almost like having my picture on the wall, too. A little piece of me still exists, even if the larger part of me can't. I pour myself a cup, then pour Mia's, adding a dash of half and half like she takes it.
"I like the pictures," I say. "Keeps things interesting."
Mia nods, blows ripples into her coffee.
"And I miss them too," I say.
"Every day."
She looks surprised at that. Not that I miss them, but I guess by my admitting it finally. She nods solemnly.
"I know," she says. She walks around the room, running her fingers lightly along the picture frames. "I'm running out of space," she says. "I had to put up a bunch of Kim's recent shots in the bathroom. Have you talked to her lately?" She must know what I did to Kim. "No."
"Really? Then you don't know about the scandal?"
I shake my head.
"She dropped out of college last year. When the war flared up in Afghanistan, Kim decided, screw it, I want to be a photographer, and the best education is in the field. So she just took her cameras and off she went. She started selling all these shots to the AP and the New York Times. She cruises around in one of those burkas and hides all her photographic equipment underneath the robes and then whips them off to get her shot."
I'll bet Mrs. Schein loves that. Kim's mom was notoriously overprotective. The last I'd heard of her, she was having a freak out that Kim was going to school across the country, which Kim had said was precisely the point. Mia laughs.
"At first, Kim told her family she was just taking a semester off, but now she's getting really successful, so she's officially dropped out. And Mrs. Schein has officially had a nervous breakdown. And then there's the fact that Kim's a nice Jewish girl in a very Muslim country."
Mia blows on her coffee and sips.
"But on the other hand, now Kim gets her stuff in the New York Times, and she just got a feature assignment for National Geographic, so it gives Mrs. Schein some bragging ammo."
"Hard for a mother to resist," I say.
"She's a big Shooting Star fan, you know."
"Mrs. Schein? I always had her pegged as more hip-hop."
Mia grins. "No, she's into death metal, hardcore. Kim, she saw you guys play in Bangkok. Said it poured rain and you played right through it."
"She was at that show? I wish she would have come backstage, said hi," I say, even though I know why she wouldn't have. Still, she came to the show. She must have forgiven me a little bit.
"I told her the same thing, but she had to leave right away. She was supposed to be in Bangkok for some R&R, but that rain you were playing in was actually a cyclone somewhere else, and she had to run off and cover it. She's a very badass shutter babe these days."
I think of Kim chasing Taliban insurgents and ducking flying trees. It's surprisingly easy to imagine.
"It's funny," I begin. "What is?" Mia asks.
"Kim being a war photographer, all danger girl."
"Yeah, it's a laugh riot."
"That's not how I meant.
It's just Kim, you, me.
We all came from this nowhere town in Oregon, and look at us. All three of us have gone to, well, extremes. You gotta admit, it's kind of weird."
"It's not weird at all,"
Mia says, shaking out a bowl of cornflakes.
"We were all forged in the crucible. Now come on, have some cereal."
I'm not hungry. I'm not even sure I can eat a single cornflake, but I sit down because my place at the Hall family table has just been restored. Time has a weight to it, and right now I can feel it heavy over me. It's almost 3 o'clock. Another day is half over, and tonight I leave for the tour. I hear the clicking of the antique clock on Mia's wall. I let the minutes go by longer than I should before I finally speak. "We both have our flights. I should probably get moving," I say. My voice sounds far away, but I feel weirdly calm. "Are there taxis around here?"
"No, we get back and forth to Manhattan by river raft," she jokes.
"You can call a car," she adds after a moment. I stand up, make my way toward the kitchen counter where Mia's phone sits.
"What's the number?"
I ask.
718,
Mia begins. Then she interrupts herself.
"Wait."
At first I think she has to pause to recall the number, but I see her eyes, at once unsure and imploring.
"There's one last thing,"
she continues, her voice hesitant.
"Something I have that really belongs to you."
"My wiper's t-shirt?"
She shakes her head. "That's long gone, I'm afraid. Come on, it's upstairs."
I follow her up the creaking steps. At the top of the narrow landing to my right, I can see her bedroom with its slanted ceilings. To my left is a closed door. Mia opens it, revealing a small studio. In the corner is a cabinet with a keypad. Mia punches in a code and the door opens. When I see what she pulls out of the cabinet, at first I'm like, "Oh, right. My guitar." Because here in Mia's little house in Brooklyn is my old electric guitar, my Les Paul Jr. The guitar I bought at a pawn shop with my pizza delivery earnings when I was a teenager.
It's the guitar I used to record all our stuff leading up to and including Collateral Damage. It's the guitar I auctioned off for charity and have regretted doing so ever since. It's sitting in its old case, with my old Fugazi and K-Records stickers, with the stickers from Mia's dad's old band, even. Everything is the same. The strap, the dent from when I dropped it off a stage, even the dust smells familiar. And I'm just taking it all in, so it's a few seconds before it really hits me. This is my guitar. Mia has my guitar. Mia is the one who bought my guitar for some exorbitant sum, which means that Mia knew it was up for auction. I look around the room. Among the sheet music and cello paraphernalia is a pile of magazines, my face peeking out from the covers. And then I remember something back on the bridge, Mia justifying why she left me by reciting the lyrics to Roulette. And suddenly, it's like I've been wearing earplugs all night and they've fallen out, and everything that was muffled is now clear, but also so loud and jarring. Mia has my guitar. It's such a straightforward thing, and yet I don't know that I would have been more surprised had Teddy popped out of the closet. I feel faint. I sit down. Mia stands right in front of me, holding my guitar by the neck, offering it back to me. You? Is all I can manage to choke out. Always me, she replies softly, bashfully. Who else? My brain has vacated my body. My speech is reduced to the barest of basics. But why? Somebody had to save it from the Hard Rock Cafe, Mia says with a laugh, but I can hear the potholes in her voice too. But I grasp for the words like a drowning man reaching for floating debris. You said you hated me. Mia lets out a long, deep sigh. I know. I needed someone to hate. And you're the one I love the most, so it fell to you. She's holding out the guitar, nudging it toward me. She wants me to take it, but I couldn't lift a cotton ball right now. She keeps staring, keeps offering. But what about Ernesto? A look of puzzlement flits across her face, followed by amusement. He's my mentor, Adam, my friend. He's married. She looks down for a beat. When her gaze returns, her amusement has hardened into defensiveness. Besides, why should you care? Go back to your ghost, I hear Bryn telling me. But she has it wrong. Bryn is the one who's been living with the ghost, the specter of a man who never stopped loving someone else. There never would have been a Bryn if you hadn't decided you needed to hate me, I reply. Mia takes this one square on the chin. I don't hate you. I don't think I ever really did. It was just anger. And once I faced it head on, once I understood it, it dissipated. She looks down, takes a deep breath, and exhales a tornado. I know I owe you some kind of an apology. I've been trying to get it out all night, but it's like those words, apology, sorry, are too measly for what you deserve. She shakes her head. I know what I did to you was so wrong, but at the time it also felt so necessary to my survival. I don't know if those two things can both be true, but that's how it was. If it's any comfort, after a while, when it didn't feel necessary anymore, when it felt hugely wrong, all I was left with was the magnitude of my mistake, of my missing you. And I had to watch you from this distance, watch you achieve your dreams, live what seemed like this perfect life. It's not perfect, I say. I get that now. But how was I supposed to know? You were so very, very far from me. And I'd accepted that as my punishment for what I'd done. And then, she trails off. What? She takes a gulp of air and grimaces. And then Adam Wilde shows up at Carnegie Hall on the biggest night of my career. And it felt like more than a coincidence. It felt like a gift from them. For my first recital ever, they gave me a cello, and for this one, they gave me you. Every hair on my body stands on end, my whole body alert with a chill. She hastily wipes tears from her eyes with the back of her hand and takes a deep breath. Here,
Are you going to take this thing or what? I haven't tuned it for a while.
I used to have dreams like this. Mia back from the not dead, in front of me, alive to me. But it got so even in the dreams I knew they were unreal and could anticipate the blare of my alarm, so I'm kind of listening now, waiting for the alarm to go off. But it doesn't. And when I close my fingers around the guitar, the wood and strings are solid and root me to the earth. They wake me up, and she's still here. And she's looking at me, at my guitar, and at her cello, and at the clock on the windowsill. And I see what she wants, and it's the same thing I've wanted for years now, but I can't believe that after all this time, and now that we're out of time, she's asking for it. But still, I give a little nod. She plugs in the guitar, tosses me the cord, and turns on the amp. "Can you give me an E?" I ask. Mia plucks her cello's E string. I tune from that, and then I strum an A minor. And as the cord bounces off the walls, I feel that dash of electricity shimmy up my spine in a way it hasn't done for a long, long time. I look at Mia. She's sitting across from me, her cello between her legs. Her eyes are closed, and I can tell she's doing that thing, listening for something in the silence. Then all at once, Mia seems to have heard what she needs to hear. Her eyes are open and on me again, like they never left. She picks up her bow, gestures toward my guitar with a slight tilt of her head. "Are you ready?" she asks. There are so many things I'd like to tell her. Top among them is that I've always been ready. But instead, I turn up the amp, fish a pick out of my pocket, and just say yes. Chapter 21. We play for what seems like hours, days, years, or maybe it's seconds. I can't even tell anymore. We speed up, then slow down. We scream our instruments. We grow serious. We laugh. We grow quiet, then loud. My heart is pounding. My blood is grooving. My whole body is thrumming as I'm remembering. Concert doesn't mean stand up like a target in front of thousands of strangers. It means coming together. It means harmony. When we finally pause, I'm sweating and Mia's panting hard, like she's just sprinted for miles. We sit there in silence, the sound of our rapid breaths slowing in tandem, the beats of our hearts steadying. I look at the clock. It's past 5. Mia follows my gaze. She lays down her bow. "What now?" she asks. "Schubert? Ramones?" I say, though I know she's not taking requests. But all I can think to do is keep playing, because for the first time in a long time, there's nothing more I want to do. And I'm scared of what happens when the music ends. Mia gestures to the digital clock flashing ominously from the windowsill. "I don't think you'll make your flight." I shrug. Never mind the fact that there are at least 10 other flights to London tonight alone. "Can you make yours?" "I don't want to make mine," she says shyly. "I have a spare day before the recitals begin. I can leave tomorrow." All of a sudden, I picture Aldous pacing in Virgin's departure lounge, wondering where the hell I am, calling a cell phone that's still sitting on some hotel nightstand. I think of Bryn out in L.A., unaware of an earthquake going down here in New York that's sending a tsunami her way. And I realize that before there's a next, there's a now that needs attending to. "I need to make some phone calls," I tell Mia, "to my manager, who's waiting for me, and to Bryn." "Oh, right. Of course," she says, her face falling as she rushes to stand up, almost toppling her cello in her fluster. "The phone's downstairs, and I should call Tokyo, except I'm pretty sure it's the middle of the night, so I'll just email and call later. And my travel agent..." "Mia," I interrupt.
"What?"
"We'll figure this out."
"Really?"
She doesn't look so sure.
I nod, though my own heart is pounding and the puzzle pieces are whirling as Mia places the cordless phone in my hand. I go into her garden where it's private and peaceful in the afternoon light, the summer cicadas chirping up a storm. Aldous picks up on the first ring, and the minute I hear his voice and start talking, reassuring him that I'm okay, the plans start coming out of my mouth as though long, long contemplated. I explain that I'm not coming to London now. That I'm not making any music video or doing any interviews, but that I'll be in England for the kickoff of our European tour, and that I'll play every single one of those shows. The rest of the plan that's formulating in my head, part of which already solidified in some nebulous way last night on the bridge, I keep to myself, but I think Aldous senses it. I can't see Aldous, so I can't know if he blinks or flinches or looks surprised, but he doesn't miss a beat. "You'll honor all your tour commitments?" he repeats. "Yep." "What am I supposed to say to the band?" "They can make the video without me if they want." "I'll see them at the Guildford Festival," I say, referring to the big music festival in England that we're headlining to kick off our tour. "And I'll explain everything then." "Where are you going to be in the meantime, if anyone needs you?" "Tell anyone not to need me," I answer. The next call is harder. I wish I hadn't chosen today to give up smoking. Instead, I do the deep breathing exercises like the doctors showed me and just dial. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with 10 digits, right? "I thought that might be you," Bryn says when she hears my voice. "Did you lose your phone again? Where are you?" "I'm in New York still, in Brooklyn." I pause. "With Mia." Stone's silence fills the line, and I fill that silence with a monologue that's, what, I don't know, a running explanation of the night that happened by accident, an acknowledgement that things never were right between us, right the way she wanted them to be, and as a result, I've been a dick of a boyfriend. I tell her I hope she'll do better with the next guy. "Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that," she says with an attempt at a cackle, but it doesn't quite come out that way. There's a long pause. I'm waiting for her tirade, her recriminations, all the things I have coming, but she doesn't say anything. "Are you still there?" I ask.
"Yeah, I'm thinking."
"About what?"
"I'm thinking about whether I'd rather she'd have died."
"Jesus, Bryn."
"Oh, shut up. You don't get to be the outraged one, not right now. And the answer's no. I don't wish her dead."
She pauses.
"Not so sure about you, though."
Then she hangs up. I stand there, still clutching the phone to my ear, taking in Bryn's last words, wondering if there might have been a shred of absolution in her hostility. I don't know if it matters, because as I smell the cooling air, I feel release and relief wash over me. After a while, I look up. Mia's standing at the sliding glass door, awaiting the all clear. I give her a dazed wave, and she slowly makes her way to the bricked patio where I'm standing, still holding the phone. She grabs hold of the top of the phone, like it's a relay baton, about to be passed off.
"Is everything okay?" she asks.
"I'm freed, shall we say, from my previous commitments."
"Of the tour?"
she sounds surprised. I shake my head. "Not the tour, but all the crap leading up to it. And my other, entanglements."
"Oh."
We both just stand there for a while, grinning like goofballs, still grasping the cordless. Finally, I let it go and then gently detach the receiver from her grasp and place it on the iron table, never releasing my grip of her hand. I run my thumb over the calluses on her thumb and up and down the bony ridge of her knuckles and wrist. It's at once so natural and such a privilege. This is Mia I'm touching, and she's allowing it. Not just allowing it, but closing her eyes and leaning into it. "Is this real? Am I allowed to hold this hand?" I ask, bringing it up to my stubbly cheek. Mia's smile is melting chocolate. It's a kick-ass guitar solo. It's everything good in this world. She answers. I pull her to me. 1,000 suns rise from my chest. "Am I allowed to do this?" I ask, taking both of her arms in mine and slow dancing her around the yard. Her entire face is smiling now.
"You're allowed," she murmurs.
I run my hands up and down her bare arms. I spin her around the planters, bursting with fragrant flowers.
I bury my head into her hair and breathe the smell of her, of the New York City night that's seared into her. I follow her gaze upward to the heavens.
"So do you think they're watching us?"
I ask, as I give the scar on her shoulder the slightest of kisses and feel arrows of heat shoot through every part of me.
"Who?"
Mia asks, leaning into me, shivering slightly.
"Your family. You seem to think they keep tabs on you. You think they can see this?"
I loop my arms around her waist and kiss her right behind her ear, the way that used to drive her crazy, the way that, judging by the sharp intake of breath and the nails that dig into my side, still does. It occurs to me that there's seemingly something creepy in my line of questioning, but it doesn't feel that way. Last night, the thought of her family knowing my actions shamed me, but now, it's not like I want them to see this, but I want them to know about it, about us. I like to think they give me some privacy, she says, opening up like a sunflower to the kisses I'm planting on her jaw. But my neighbors can definitely see this. She runs her hand through my hair, and it's like she electrocuted my scalp, if electrocution felt so good. Howdy, neighbor, I say, tracing lazy circles around the base of her clavicle with my finger. Her hands dip under my t-shirt, my dirty, stinky, thank-you-lucky black t-shirt. Her touch isn't so gentle anymore. It's probing, the fingertips starting to tap out a Morse code of urgency. If this goes on much longer, my neighbors are going to get a show, she whispers. We are performers, after all, I reply, slipping my hands under her shirt and running them up the length of her long torso, then back down again. Our skins reach outward, like magnets long deprived of their opposite charge. I run my finger along her neck, her jawline, and then cup her chin in my hand, and stop. We stand there for a moment, staring at each other, savoring it. And then all at once, we slam together.
Mia's legs are off the ground, wrapped around my waist, her hands digging in my hair, my hands tangled in hers, and our lips. There isn't enough skin, enough spit, enough time for the lost years that our lips are trying to make up for as they find each other. We kiss.
The electric current switches to high. The lights throughout all of Brooklyn must be surging. Inside, Mia half orders, half begs, and with her legs still wrapped around me, I carry her back into her tiny home, back to the couch where only hours before we'd slept, separately, together. This time, we're wide awake, and all together. We fall asleep, waking in the middle of the night, ravenous. We order takeout, eat it upstairs in her bed. It's all like a dream. Only the most incredible part is waking up at dawn, with Mia. I see her sleeping form there and feel as happy as I've ever been. I pull her to me and fall back asleep. But when I wake again a few hours later, Mia's sitting on a chair under the window, her legs wrapped in a tight ball, her body covered in an old afghan that her grand crocheted, and she looks miserable, and the fear that lands like a grenade in my gut is almost as bad as anything I've ever feared with her. And that's saying a lot. All I can think is, I can't lose you again. It really will kill me this time. What's wrong? I ask, before I lose the nerve to ask it and do something dumb like walk away before my heart gets truly incinerated. I was just thinking about high school, Mia says sadly.
That would put anyone in a foul mood.
Mia doesn't take the bait. She doesn't laugh. She slumps in the chair. I was thinking about how we're in the same boat all over again. When I was on my way to Juilliard and you were on your way to, well, where you are now. She looks down, twists the yarn from the blanket around her finger until the skin of the tip goes white. Except we had more time back then to worry about it. And now we have a day, or had a day. Last night was amazing, but it was just one night. I really do have to leave for Japan in like 7 hours. And you have the band, your tour. She presses against her eyes with the heels of her hands.
Mia, stop.
My voice bounces off her bedroom walls. We are not in high school anymore. She looks at me, a question hanging in the air. Look, my tour doesn't start for another week. A feather of hope starts to float across the space between us. And you know, I was thinking I was craving some sushi. Her smile is sad and rueful, not exactly what I was going for. You'd come to Japan with me? She asks. I'm already there. I would love that. But then what? I mean, I know we can figure something out, but I'm going to be on the road so much, and how can it be so unclear to her when it's like the fingers on my hand to me? I'll be your plus one,
I tell her. You're groupie, you're roadie, you're whatever. Wherever you go, I go. If you want that. If you don't, I understand. No, I want that.